Okay. Welcome to Monday. No. Sorry. But there must be some satisfaction in knowing that you totally ruined Talia's weekend. Did you do anything fun this weekend at all? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for all that hard work. And do we have any announcements? No? As soon as they're finished, which now rests on my shoulders. So it depends on how much sleep I need over the next couple of days. I know how much I need. It's a matter of whether I get it. I'm not looking for sympathy. I just want to complain a little bit. Now, this is the week when I'm on two major committees and one new committee, and they all decided to meet on Wednesday. Yeah. And one of them met today and will meet on Wednesday, and then we'll meet again on Friday. And it's one of the committees, you don't need to know this, but you know what happens to faculty when they, after they've been here 5 years, going on six, if they're tenure-track faculty, they get evaluated pretty thoroughly. And they either get tenure at the end of 6 years or they go someplace else and do something else. And the committee that I'm on that's meeting three times this week is one of the committees that evaluates those faculty. They get evaluated by the department faculty, the chair of the department, the college faculty, the dean, a Senate faculty committee, and then the provost. And if you get through all that, you can keep your job and maybe even get promoted. So it's kind of serious work. But not as serious as grading your exams, so we will get that done too. Any questions? Reminder that this unit has lots of reading. So do it all before Thanksgiving break, right? Right. Okay. Second, when you get the exams back, there will be another exam analysis opportunity for extra credit. And even if you didn't do the first one, you will be able to do the second one. So don't throw your paper away. And I will put that assignment up on the website probably Wednesday, if that's when we're giving the exams back. And there are some updates for the website for this unit that haven't gone up yet, but they will go up this week. Okay. Is that it? We're okay. We're recording, too. Good. These are the focus questions that I put up on Wednesday as we started this unit, and today we're going to look at the first one, what is temperament, particularly. And then I'm going to address one particular approach to thinking about the eighth question as we look at what maturity might mean. And I'll give you one set of ideas about emotional maturity. Okay, so the study of temperament has been of interest to thinkers and amateur psychologists and parents and all different kinds of people for many years, going way back, Plato, some of the Greeks, probably other people in other traditions that I'm not knowledgeable about, have talked about the different kinds of personalities. And in doing that, many of them have suggested that there are some innate differences, some biological differences in how people function that contribute to differences among us. There are wonderful words for personalities that are based on which body organs are most active. So we have words such as splenetic, which refers to a person who has a lot of spleen activity producing bile. And we have people who are referred to in other ways on the basis of their physical constitution. Most importantly, if parents have a couple of children, they're likely to note that these children come into the world with their own ways of interacting with the world, with their own styles. And parents will often say that although they thought they were going to treat their children equally and the same, the children are creating transactions with the parents that are quite different because the children have different personalities, even if they're the same sex. So you can have two or three girls in a family, and one of them, or all three of them, will be different from the others. You can have boys, and they're quite different. And if you get parents to ask about how those children are different, they often refer to characteristics that are reflected in this slide, which I can't show all of. I need to revise it so it'll all go up at the same time. But it's listed in the text. It's drawn from the New York Longitudinal Study of Temperament, which was conducted by a child psychiatrist named Stella Chess and her colleagues, Herb Birch and what's his name, Thomas. Chess, Thomas, and Birch. I've just totally blocked on what Thomas's first name was, but you don't need to know. Anyways, Chess, Thomas, and Birch. And what Stella Chess noticed back in the 1940s and 50s was that parents were referring to characteristics that they thought they couldn't do anything about, that the parents couldn't do anything about. Kids' rhythms were different, their sensitivity to environmental stimulation, their need for quiet, the negativity of their responses. Parents would come in and complain that they were having difficulty getting along with one of their children because the kid always seemed to be resistant to any new idea. That the kid always said no first. And it wasn't just the two-year-old no, the negative stage, but these were kids who seemed to always be dissatisfied and uncomfortable. So Chess, Thomas, and Birch got together and decided that this notion of kids having different personalities from the very beginning was so ubiquitous, it was so general in the society, that it needed scientific study, and it had not had much in the way of scientific study. So the first question for them was, what are the differences that we can actually assess in the first few months of life? How are kids different from each other? A little hard to do IQ tests. We know about height and weight, but how are their personalities different in the first few months of life? Are there ways to rate them? So they put together a study in which they looked at a variety of infants. They also interviewed parents to see how the parents thought about their kids as being different, and also a rating study, an assessment study, in which they tried to determine if you could interact with an infant for a while, or two or three or four infants, and describe differences among them. And they came up with nine characteristics of temperament. They call them components of temperament. And these are defined in the text, so you don't need to write them all down. They're also on the website. But we can talk very briefly about each of them, and all of them are, to some degree, reliable differences. That is, you can look at two kids and see that they are fairly consistently different in these ways. And one is activity level. Some kids simply have more energy and engage in more activity than other kids. Because in the first unit, I asserted that boys are more active prenatally and through the rest of childhood and adolescence. That's still true. But even among the girls and among the boys, you have wide variations in how energetic kids are, how much activity they engage in. The second important feature for parents is how rhythmically regular the kids are. And they range from kids who are just absolutely regular. They go to sleep at the same time. They get hungry at the same time, day after day after day. They crap at the same time. They're very regular in their biological rhythms. And then at the other end of the continuum, you have kids who are completely unpredictable. A kid who might sleep a couple of hours at a time and want to nurse, and one night, and then the next night sleep 6 or 7 hours and wake up and want to nurse, and then the third night go back to 2 or 3 hours and want to nurse. You have kids who, as they get a little bit older and you start trying to toilet train them at 6 months or 7 months, which is too early to toilet train them, but you want to get them used to sitting on the pot, you discover that some kids will wake up in the morning, have breakfast, 20 minutes later, they will poop. And that's predictable. Those kids are wonderfully easy to toilet train. You let them wake up in the morning, you feed them breakfast, you watch your watch. 15 minutes later, you say, sit here. You put them on the potty chair, and in 5 minutes, you give them something to play with, and 5 minutes later, they poop. And they do that day after day after day, and you figure, okay, they're trained. What's really happened is the parents are trained, but they are trained by their transactions with a kid who is very regular. Other kids get up in the morning, they have breakfast, they poop while they're eating breakfast. One day. And the next day, they don't poop at all. And the next day, they poop before breakfast and at lunch and in the bathtub. They're just irregular. Their body rhythms, their diurnal rhythms, just aren't predictable. Now, you can imagine that kids on the ends of that continuum are very different to parent. The kid who's very, very regular and predictable is pretty easy to parent compared to the kid who is unpredictable. You don't know when the kid's going to be hungry. You don't know when the kid's going to have a bowel movement. You don't know when the kid is going to sleep. You know, just different. And they place different demands on parents. One of the reliable differences is approach to new stimuli, new foods. And some kids are the really eager ones. You show somebody something new, and the kid goes after it. You see another kid the same age, you show them a new toy, and they're, wait a minute, you know, not going to touch that one yet. What is it? Something new. I don't want it. Those are the kids who are hard to buy presents for because they don't like anything that you give them. Till 2 or 3 days later, and then they warm up and they're okay with it. Some kids will go after new food. They will even declare things to be food that you don't want them to eat. They have, you know, they're very eager to put anything in their mouths and accept it as food, whether it is or not, in your view. And other kids don't want anything new. The kid who takes months to decide that a different kind of fruit is okay. Everybody else is eating it, but this kid doesn't want it. Okay. Adaptability. How easy can you change your initial response? Some of us are really stubborn. We get something in our minds as kids, and we are going after it, and you're not going to distract me. And I'm not going to change my mind. This is the way we do things. But honey, we've moved to a new house. We have a completely different floor plan. You can't go the way you used to go. You have to adapt to that new situation. Some kids are very easy to adapt to the new schedule, to the new situation, to the new possibilities, the new equipment, and other kids are not. One of my favorite kids who was not very adaptable just drove his parents nuts. He was two, and they, after waiting for a long time, finally got a new minivan, and they were really, really happy. The big sister was really happy with the car because the seats were higher and she could see out the window, and this kid who was two refused to get in it. Literally. He went out the front door. They were going someplace. He looked. The old blue Chevy wasn't there. There was this wonderful shiny maroon minivan. And he looked around and he started to whimper. And his parents started to put him in the nice shiny minivan and he started to scream. He'd never been anyplace except in the old blue Chevy. And he wasn't going for a ride in this new car. And he kept it up for 2 weeks. They put him in anyway because they were going. They strapped him in his seat. And he screamed. And his screaming gradually got shorter and shorter. But he's sort of the definition of not very adaptable. You know, how many kids really care what they're riding in? You know, most don't. This kid, right there. Very not adaptable. We had a wonder. We have a. He was one in May. We have a 17 or 18 month who hangs out a lot, and he came for dinner Halloween night with his parents. Did a little trick or treating with these three little kids, and it was lots of fun. There's this little kid walked in, and my wife had put the seat that's tied to, strapped to the kitchen chair that he always sits in. It's his seat, his tray, that's where he goes. She had put it in the dining room at the dining room table because there were going to be 10 or 11 of us. And so he walked in and he looked around and there weren't any dining room chairs because we have to move them into the, or kitchen chairs because we have to move them into the dining room. And he walked into the dining room. He's very resourceful and he's very smart, and he looked and there was his chair. So he grabbed his chair and started pulling it to the kitchen because that's where his chair belongs. He's a creature of habit. He's slow to adapt, but he does pretty well. And once it was explained to him that we were all going to eat in the dining room and this was a new experience, he decided that was okay. He kind of kept looking back at the kitchen. And at the end of the evening, being as clever as we are, we decided, okay, we need to let him know that his world is still intact. So we moved the kitchen chair with his tray and seat back to its normal place. And he was visibly relieved. Okay, that's right. We're not going to eat in the dining room all the time. He was okay with that. Threshold of responsiveness. How much stimulation is required to evoke a response? Now, some kids, you walk into the room, say, "Hi, Charlie," and the kid ignores you. And you say, "Hi, Charlie," and you're still ignored. You have to go up and kind of jiggle the kid and, you know, slap him around. No, you don't slap him around. You just shake him up. You make your presence known. And the kid's not deaf. He's just not paying any attention to you. Other kids, you come in the door, and they're alerting. Who's that? Those kids also are different to parent. The kid who's not paying any attention to you as a parent requires you to be more vigorous and insistent. The kid who's always watching you and ready to respond to you evokes a different response from you as a parent. How energetic are you? What happens when you tell the kid we're having chocolate ice cream for dinner? One kid looks at you and says, "Oh." Okay. And you know the kid loves chocolate ice cream and is going to eat it quite enthusiastically, but there it is. Okay. Another kid, you say, we're going to have chocolate ice cream for dessert, and the kid's all over it and doesn't want to eat dinner because we're going to have chocolate ice cream, and I'm really excited about that, and I want to leave room. So, the quality of mood. Are you... I assume that all of you are thinking about your roommates now. Okay. They have temperaments. Are you thinking about these? What's the quality of mood? Do you have the roommate who's always just positive, even when you wish you'd have some company in your depression, feeling overwhelmed? You don't get any sympathy because he's always... Hey, okay, yeah, hi, fine, everything's fine. Or do you have the roommate from hell who's always negative, no matter what happens? Yeah. Let's do this, I don't want to do this. Let's study tonight, I don't want to study tonight. Mm-hmm. With infants and toddlers, you get that same feeling. Some of them are really, really positive, they've always got a smile. One of my favorites was my daughter, who just always is positive. She's upbeat about most everything. And one time when she was sitting up, not sure if she was walking yet, so she was about 7 or 8 months. And we knew she had a cold, and I heard her whimpering in the middle of the night. So I walked into her room quietly, and I could tell she was awake because I could hear her whimpering, so I turned on the nightlight so I could see her. And there she was, sitting up in bed. And she looked at me, and she looked absolutely miserable. You know that cold face? The puffiness and the drippiness and the swollen eyes. And she looked at me, and she gave me this wonderful smile. I'm like, oh, I'm so happy to see you. Yeah. So I could tell she had a fever. She was not very happy. First thing in the morning, off to the pediatrician. He looks in her ears, and she's sitting on the examining table. He's looked in her ears, and he says, I don't know why she's not screaming. Both eardrums are ready to burst. And she has an incredible earache. This has to be really, really hurting her. And she's sitting there, smiling at him. So, and she's mostly that way. Her mood is always... up. She's very enthusiastic, pleasant, joyful. Everybody likes to be around her. I keep trying to get some of it to rub off on me. All right, distractibility. How easily can you distract the person from what he or she is doing? And finally, attention span and persistence, which is related to distractibility. Once you start something, you stay with it. Another family story. My son went to the UVM preschool, and I was supervising the students. And it's always kind of difficult to have a faculty brat in the preschool at 4. The students who have trouble with the kid and don't quite know how to address the parent. So they finally came to me and said, we have a problem with your son because he won't come to meeting. Circle time. Okay, so let's go examine this. What's he doing? He's just refusing. Okay, what's he doing? Well, he came in this morning and announced that he wanted to do woodworking, in which they had set up in the room, had a woodworking table, saws, and all that sort of stuff. Not table saws. The table and saws. And he came in and he started looking at the scrap wood, and he said, I want to make a table. And he's still like that. He was going to make that table. And nothing was going to distract him. Nothing was important enough to change his focus and do something else. Certainly not circle time. He wasn't going to do that. And so he proceeded to spend the rest of the morning, all morning, right up into lunch, making a table. And the next day he painted it yellow. And he still has that table. Okay. It's about this high, about that wide, and it's beside his bed. He is 35 years old. And we will bury that table with him. But it's a problem for teachers who get a kid who's not willing to switch focus and do something else. On the other hand, I've appreciated over the years that if he says he's going to do something, and it's something he selected and he's focused on it, that he will start it, even if it's 8 o'clock in the evening, and bedtime used to be at 9. Now I think bedtime is 4 in the morning. That's his problem, his wife's problem. And he would work on it until it was done. So I learned very early on, just go to bed. And there's no point trying to take him away from it. If he misses school the next day, that's his problem in middle school. But he will work on something that he wants to work on until it is finished, almost regardless of anything else that's going on. Okay, so Chess, Thomas, and Birch studied a bunch of kids, and they saw that they can clearly, and parents can, distinguish their kids, and that kids come in different clusters. So they took these 9 ratings that they had made on the kids, and they found that they come together in groups. They aren't independent of each other. And this is described in the text, and this table is like one that's in the text. What they did was suggest that what parents are responding to are kids who have different clusters of these temperaments. Some of them are not very rhythmic, and they're highly distractible, and they generally are negative, and they're not persistent at the right things, and we're going to call those difficult children because they, in fact, are difficult to establish a positive relationship with. Other kids have regular rhythmicity, their activity level is medium, they're positive approaching new things, they're adaptable, their mood is positive, their intensity is not great. If it is, it's positive. And these kids are really easy to parent. And parents don't have too much difficulty with them. So we call them easy kids. And others are what they call slow to warm up. And in the text you have a description of what percentage of kids fall into one or the other of these clusters. And it certainly doesn't cover all kids. There are kids who just don't fit an easy description. They don't fit easily into one of those 3 categories. What Chess, Thomas, and Birch did was write several books about this. One is the best one, if you want to follow it. The research is called Your Child is a Person. It's directed at parents. It describes these 9 components, and then it describes the clusters, and then it describes the transactions that parents have with kids, including the difficulty. And what they argue is that a lot of the problems that parents have in raising their kids is that the parents are not accepting of who the child really is. And their argument over the years has been that your child comes into the world with a temperament, and you can contribute to making it a little bit different, but you can't fundamentally change the underlying dimensions and where the child is on them. What you can do is create problems for yourself and the child by expecting the child to be quite different than he or she is able to be. And it's not a matter of voluntarily changing the way your nervous system works. And their argument is that temperament and temperamental characteristics, these 9 components, are wired into you biologically. You can learn to express them differently, and you can learn to get along with other people in spite of the fact that you're a difficult child. And many of us would like a different label. I don't like labeling kids difficult, because I think that sets them up to be difficult. So we use the reactive negative phrase. typically, rather than difficult, because those are the ones that are likely to create problems for some parents. Chess, Thomas, and Birch have followed, well, Birch hasn't because he died. Chess is retired. Thomas is retired. They've passed this on, but they have looked now at the beginning to look at the grandchildren of the original subjects. And it's a little hard to follow people that long, but in the first wave of follow-up studies, what they found was that some people change, and many people don't. And then looking at the children, they tried to assess the temperaments of the original subjects' spouses. If they had children, they looked at what the couple did together and then temperaments of their children. And other people have continued that research on. And on the result, on the basis of that research, they asserted that it's probably fairly strongly genetic. But parents can make some characteristics be a problem, and they can make other characteristics that a child might have less problematic by how they create transactions with the child. It's also important, I think, to remember that parents also have temperaments. And if you are lucky enough to have two parents with difficult temperaments, you're quite likely to have your own difficult temperament. And if you look at the characteristics of irregular rhythmicity, high activity level, negative approach to new things, you can put together the potential for transactions within the triad, the two parents and the kid, that are likely to be problematic. And it turns out that that combination of two difficult parents and a difficult child is the best predictor of child abuse within the family. Because you have a parent who has little patience and is negatively reactive to new things. You have a kid who is intense with negative reactivity, and they end up on each other's nerves a lot. And because they're all intense, they tend to have problems with each other. So if you look at, and I hope none of you are unlucky enough to be in that kind of situation, but if you look at the two parents, they're fighting with each other because they annoy each other. And when the kid is annoying, then the parents fight with each other, and you have the possibility of intimate violence. And people who are not very happy with each other, until they read Chess, Thomas, and Birch when they're all grown up, and then they can laugh about how much chaos and negativity and anger there was in their home when the kid was little. And then they can like each other because they recognize that we're all difficult people, and you understand me, and I understand you, and I'm glad you didn't kill me. That's the typical response of the difficult child who discovers Chess, Thomas, and Birch. Kids who have parents with different temperaments are lucky if one of those is an easy temperament, because then the kid will find one parent who is easy to get along with and less likely to blow up when the kid does something wrong. Many families who think they've got this parenting stuff all in hand, and we look at them as really good parents, many of them are too easy parents with easy kids. And if you can't parent well when you have an easy temperament and nobody else in the family is different from you and everybody is generally positive, if you can't do it then, you probably can't do it. But I'm reluctant to give those parents a lot of credit. Some of you probably are easy people and have two easy parents. I don't think they have any challenges. I think that's the least challenging set of transactions to grow up in. And they should consider themselves really fortunate because they don't have the challenges that people who are much more negative and reactive have. Okay. People typically criticize Chess, Thomas, and Birch. All of the criticisms of their research techniques, their methodology, are probably valid. I don't argue with those. But what I like to do is ask people to do a self-evaluation of you, your parents, your siblings, and then look at the transactions between you and see if the notion of temperament helps you understand the ease or some of the challenges that you have with family members or with your roommates or with your partners. And then, therapeutically, study the notion that Chess, Thomas, and Birch present, which is described and defined in the text, the notion of goodness of fit. And what Chess, Thomas, and Birch argue is that we need to look at the transaction, the fit, between the parents and the child. And some of the parents who have real problems with their kids and vice versa have the expectation that their child will be quite different than the child actually can be. Their expectations, their responses to the child are not appropriate because they're based on shaming the child for the kind of personality that he or she has, the temperament of constantly being dissatisfied because the child is not doing what the parents think children ought to do. And the parents just aren't paying attention to the way this child operates. It is possible to have a kid who's negative and reactive and intense and have a good fit with that kid because you understand the child's initial responses to things. When you have a bad fit, you have a problem. If you have a partner in adulthood who's very different from yourself, and you're expecting that person to change, you can make it a bad fit by being constantly annoyed with the person, in which case you probably ought to end the relationship. Or you can have a good fit, which says, hey, you're really creative and intense and a bit negative, and I like that, and that's kind of fun and exciting for me. Now let me help you figure out how to get along without scaring me, hurting me, disappointing me too much, but I'm not going to ask you to change a lot. I'm just going to ask you to channel it. That's creating a good fit. Example with kids. If you have one of those negative reactive kids who's not very adaptable, and you've announced what the day is going to be like, and there's your four-year-old, and you've got a schedule, and the kid has a schedule in mind, it's predictable what will happen if you suddenly announce that we were going to go get ice cream on the way to Taekwondo, but we can't, we don't have enough time, so we're just going to go straight to Taekwondo. It's predictable what's going to happen. What's going to happen? The kid's going to yell at you. You start to cry because he's not getting the ice cream he's been focusing on. And he thought we were leaving in 20 minutes and going to go get ice cream, and I'm telling him to get in the car right now. We have a problem. And the kid is going to create a problem for me. If you know that, you don't spring surprises on the non-adaptable kid. You recognize, okay, we're going to have a blow-up if I do this at the last minute, so I need to give him plenty of warning. Okay, we need to rethink about whether or not we have time to stop for ice cream on the way to Taekwondo. Maybe we have to stop afterward, so you give him the hope. And instead of leaving in 20 minutes, we need to leave in 10 minutes, not right now, in 10 minutes, so the kid has a chance to figure out, okay, things are going to be changing, and it's not what I expected, and I've got to get ready now. To give kids who are negative and not very adaptable lots of warning, you give them as many choices as you can tolerate, as long as they're reasonable choices. And when the kid does say to you, "No, I'm not going. I don't want to go to Taekwondo," you know,
I hate you.
All those things that, you know, if you were a difficult child, you hear an echo, right? You know that. If you have a sibling who's a difficult child, you hear the echo. You don't pay any attention to that. Parents who respond to that, and difficult parents are more likely to, because they're going to respond to the negativity by getting into a power struggle with the kid, and they're going to have a problem. They're going to escalate until they're both screaming at each other, and the parent makes the kid quit Taekwondo forever, and will never, ever, ever again take the kid for ice cream. Now, they've escalated that into a major brouhaha, which isn't necessary. But even if you're a difficult parent, you can say, okay, that's not personal, it's just the way he is, or she is, so I'm just going to, when the kid says, I hate you, and I'm never going to Taekwondo, you say, okay, well, we've got about 10 minutes, so I'll get my stuff ready, and I'll come back in 5 minutes and help you get your stuff ready, and you just don't respond to the negativity. And then the kid goes back to what he or she was doing, and it's gradually soaking in, slow processing, gradually soaking in that you're not going for ice cream now, you might go in after. And we're leaving pretty soon, so I've got to get ready. And the kid is processing it. And by the time you come back and remind the child, without being angry at the child or negative yourself, you have a kid who's much more willing to say, oh, okay, yeah. You come back and you say, what do you have to do to be ready? What do we have to do? How can I help you? So you're being positive and supportive, and the negative stuff that happened, which was the initial reaction, that's all gone. And you've helped the kid understand that you don't have to go through that. It'll take several years for the kid to stop having the initial eruption, but you can help the kid become much more socially acceptable, and you can do his or her future partners and children a big favor by helping the kid understand that the initial reaction that's negative is not helpful, and we need to help you find ways to short-circuit it. And by the time the kid is an adult, she will have short-circuited that. She will still have it, but she will recognize it and not splash it all over everybody else. And that's a good fit. Okay. Some people, and my favorite is Jerry Kagan, who's done the best research on temperament. He is a strong believer in temperament, and he's a faculty member at Harvard, Jerry Kagan. He's mentioned on page 201 of your text, because he has been looking for temperament that he can measure scientifically, and he's been looking at the possibility of assessing the physiological underpinnings for temperament. He's taken on that question. Are there really physiological differences between children who have different kinds of temperaments? And he's spent the last 25 years or so looking particularly at one that is quite reliable. What he did was he recruited infants into a longitudinal study, and he did all kinds of assessments on these kids from the time they were 2 or 3 months old, just to see if he could find anything that was consistent, and if you studied the same kids over a long period of time, can you find consistency? And his most dramatic finding is that he can predict which kids are going to be shy and which kids are going to be sociable, not shy and fearful, by looking at them at 4 months of age. And he can predict fairly well whether they're going to be shy or sociable and confident at 2 years. Okay, now that's pretty amazing in the first place that you can actually do that. And part of what he bases it on is, what does the kid do when you show a novel stimulus to the kid? So here's a kid sitting in a chair, 4-month-old infant, and they're really interested in the world, and there they are in the lab, and he has a whole bunch of assessments, but the kind of most dramatic one is, you give the kid a mobile, or you hang a mobile that's brightly colored and jiggly, in front of the kid's face, but not close enough for him to touch it, so it's not really scary. How many of you have seen video of this? So there you are dangling the video, and the kid's looking at it. And what he's interested in, what Kagan is interested in, is how responsive are you to that? And some kids will look at it, and they may smile, and they move around a little bit, and they watch it. Okay? They're not going after it, and they're not really excited. So that's one group. They're not terribly reactive. Another group, smaller group, is really interested, and they start to wiggle around, and you can tell they're really fascinated by this novel stimulus, and they're very reactive to it, and you think, okay, these are the kids who are really going to be confident and go after stuff. The problem is that they get so excited that they start to cry. They're very reactive to the novel stimuli. They're very different from the non-reactive kids. They're very reactive, but as they react, they begin to get distressed. And at 4 months, they're crying within a minute or so at this novel stimulus, which isn't doing anything to them except exciting them. But the excitement leads them to be distressed. And it's that level of excitement and distress that predicts whether they're going to be shy. And the kids who are distressed are going to be shy when they're two. And the explanation for that is that if that continues and these kids are exposed to new things and continually get anxious and upset, they're going to learn that new situations are bad for you. So when you put them in a new social situation, they're going to say, not me, I'm not going there. I'm going to hide behind mom. I don't want to be exposed to anything new. And that's the shy response. What Kagan finds is that this is a pretty good prediction over time. There are differences physiologically in how the kids respond. That distress response is associated with a higher stress level, higher muscular tension, reactivity in the brain. The EEG is different. And the kids, by the time they're two or three, are going to be showing you higher levels of stress hormone that's been secreted when they're exposed to new things. They also, very strangely enough, I love this one and I don't understand it, neither does he, if you measure the temperature in both ears at the same time, they're asymmetrical. Their heads are hotter on one side than the other. Something is going on with blood flow to the brain that is connected to the emotional response that the kid is having to novel stimuli. There are differences, and the developmental trajectory is that the reactive kids are going to become shy and inhibited. What he sees happening with some of these kids, and he's followed the same kids for 25 or 26 years now, what he finds is that there's this trajectory which at its worst is this fearful kid at 4 and 5 is very shy and becomes socially phobic. Okay, he won't join new groups, he won't do anything new, he doesn't like peers in middle school, and if you continue that, may become phobic in general and isolated and inhibited. So, does that mean you ought to just never expose a kid to novel stimuli? Well, that's not very possible. Should you throw the kid away because you don't want a shy, socially phobic kid? Probably not. What Kagan has done, fortunately, is to follow these kids long term, and with colleagues, he's discovered that what happens in the first 4 or 5 years is really important. And in the major study, if you follow these kids, you go to the home and you watch the mothers interact with the kids, over time, you see a very clear pattern. The kids who are not reactive, these are the ones who are going to be sociable at 2. It pretty much doesn't matter what parents do. They're just going to grow up fine. Doesn't matter if mom's neurotic. Doesn't matter if mom is kind of intrusive or overprotective. This kid is kind of impervious to mom. He's not reactive to her either. He's going to be sociable and confident. What he found is that if you watch over time, the non-reactive kids at 4 months don't become shy and inhibited. Period. They just don't. So parents are pretty irrelevant to, you need parents, but the style of parenting isn't going to be a big problem. And then you have this other group of reactive kids, and the potential for them is that they're going to become shy and inhibited. But not all of them do that. In fact, you see kids who started off reactive, and by the time they're 4 or 5, they're not shy and inhibited. What the research demonstrates is that it depends on what you do. And Park and Belsky in one study and Arcus in another one said that if you take the reactive kid and you fret and you coddle them and you let them be fearful and you protect them from new situations and stimuli, they are going to continue this trajectory. If you have the reactive kid who's starting to be shy and you say to the, oh, that's all right, dear, you don't have to do this, it's okay, and you hover and you make sure the kid is always okay, you're reinforcing that pattern. You're letting them get away with being reactive and you're teaching them that shyness and fearfulness is okay and that mommy or daddy, mommy particularly, will protect them. Okay? So if you fret and you hover and you share essentially the child's fearfulness, if you're anxious about them, it's always interesting to talk to parents who are really anxious about their kids, because what you watch happening is that the kids are going to grow up just like the parents. They're going to be anxious and fearful. But if you're supportive of reaching out, if you help the child understand the situation and cope, and if you set limits, if you're really clear about what your expectations are, not in a negative way, not shape up and be a man, but, wait a minute, you can do this, we're going to this party, and yes, it might be difficult for you, but I expect you to figure out together how you can go in and not break down in tears, so let's rehearse that. How are you going to act? And we're not going to let you stay fearful and anxious. So you help the child understand the situation, what's going to happen, you help the child cope, and you don't fret, and you don't hover. You indicate your support for the child and your confidence that the child will become confident, and the kid does that. So the parents who are so sympathetic and empathetic because the kid is like them and shy and fearful and they're going to teach the kid to be shy and fearful are going to have a kid who's shy and fearful. The parents who say, being shy and fearful is okay, but there are going to be times when you don't need to do that and I can help you learn to cope with the world more confidently, and that's what we're going to do together, and I'm right here with you, but I'm not right here to keep you out of the new situation, I'm right here to help you deal with it. Those parents have a good fit, and they are going to teach the kid to be not shy and fearful. So parents do make a difference, and it's a very important difference in the very early years. Another of the characteristics that I like, if you look at these kids who change, they're more likely to have had different levels of brain activity as early as 9 months. Okay, so you assess them at 4 months, and you can begin to see differences by 9 months in the brain activity of these kids. So that this group that's becoming more confident is actually showing a different kind of emotional responsiveness in the brain. And the Fox and Henderson study also found that the kids who change and become more confident were more likely to have had experience with caregivers other than mother. And that means a nanny or daycare, child care of some sort. And what that suggests to me is that if you're with your mother and she's anxious and fearful and that's all you're with, then you're likely to just follow along that trajectory. But if you have other people who are less likely to hover, maybe less attentive, and more expectation, they have more expectation that you're going to cope, you will. And that'll happen in a childcare situation. It'll happen with a nanny who's not going to hover because she's not going to put up with your fearful behavior. She's going to be supportive, or he. You'll see then the differences. So if you're advising parents and you see the kid is reactive and you know that mom, who's likely to be spending a lot of time with this child, is also anxious and reactive, you recommend childcare. You recommend that at least part of the time this kid be in somebody else's care so that you can keep mom from having this consistent impact on the child. Schwartz followed some of these kids up. He assessed them at 2. He took the kids that Kagan had assessed. And he looked at their responsiveness to familiar and unfamiliar faces at age 22 years. The amygdala particularly, which is the locus that lights up when you're having a negative emotional response or anxiety. And what he found was that the kids who were both types of kids, if you showed them familiar faces, they weren't anxious. But if you took the uninhibited group, the kids who weren't shy, and looked at them on familiar and unfamiliar faces, they were still the same. So they weren't having an emotional response to the unfamiliar faces. But if you looked at the inhibited, measured at 2 years, 20 years later, you see the higher amygdala response to unfamiliar faces. So 20 years later, they are having an anxious response to unfamiliar faces in a test situation. So Schwartz and his colleagues argue that there is a physiological basis. It's fairly consistent. You can change it, but you need to change it in the first 2 or 3 years. That the early years are most important in helping kids deal with new situations more confidently. Okay, let's go under that a little bit and look at that anxiety. And what's happening with people who are fearful or anxious, and I'm going to add to this people who are experiencing emotions like anger or fear or grief or any other strong emotion that you would like to throw in the mix. I'm going to talk about the work of Murray Bowen. Murray Bowen was a psychiatrist who was one of the early inventors of the field of family systems thinking and family systems therapy. Bowen, I'm not going to go into his family systems theory or that. We'll talk a little bit about that in 60. Next semester, we'll talk about more in 260 if you take the family systems theory course. But what I'm particularly interested in is Bowen's developmental scheme. He had a developmental theory that was very simple about emotional maturity and what happens to us as we're developing. First, we start, he said, with the notion of emotions. Emotions are physiological responses to situations, being hungry, being frightened, grieving, whatever the situation is. You have an emotional reaction to that. Experience creates connections between situations and emotional response. So we learn to be fearful in some situations. We learn to be angry in other situations. And emotions can be triggered by particular situations that are similar to situations when we've experienced those emotions before. So just as a typical example, if you're used to being dumped on by your romantic partners, you've had that situation, and it's kind of anxiety-producing when your partner tells you you're a schmuck and you don't deserve to have a reasonable relationship because you don't know how to treat a man or woman or whatever, whoever you are. You have that experience a few times, and what you're likely to discover is that as you get into a new relationship that starts to get close, you begin to have the same feelings that you've had in the previous ones when you've been dumped on, and you have those feelings without getting dumped on yet. But you're in a situation that is like the situation that caused your former partners to dump you. So you start to get anxious, or you start to feel the fear that this relationship is going to end. And as you start to experience that emotion, you change your behavior. And sometimes it may become a self-fulfilling prophecy. Because you're behaving weirdly now, you're likely to get dumped. You're behaving weirdly because you were afraid of getting dumped. So the dumper is responding to your notion that she or he might dump you, even though it hadn't occurred to him or her before, but then you started behaving weirdly and having odd emotional responses to normal everyday events. So you're being triggered. Your emotions are being triggered by the situation that you're in because it's similar to other situations where you've felt strong emotion. Okay, another basic fact. Emotions are contagious. If somebody is feeling anxious in your presence, you are likely to be feeling anxious. If somebody is feeling grief, having experienced some major loss, and is sitting in front of you talking about that loss and tearing up, you're likely to start to tear up. We cry when other people cry. If you go into a situation where everybody's happy and they're having a great time, and you don't even have to know why they're happy, you walk into their presence, you feel your smile muscles starting to contract, and you start to smile. Which is why, and this is good advice, you can go to a party where everybody's having a great time and being very sociable because they're drinking too much. You don't even have to drink. You can have a great time watching them behave like idiots, but you can also have a great time just because their drunkenness, their giddiness, is contagious, and you can feel it, and you can participate in it, and you don't have to have any alcohol. So they have the hangover the next morning, which you don't have to share with them. Babies respond to other babies' emotions. Everybody in the newborn nursery knows this. If you have, what happens when one kid starts to cry? They all do. So what do you do with the one who's crying? Out! You remove that kid as quickly as possible. The alternatives are to put your hand over the kid's nose and mouth, which is done in some cultures, where crying is not acceptable. The kid will learn very quickly not to cry if you do that, because panic will take over, and then you release your hand when they start to. And if they start to cry, you can teach a kid very quickly not to cry. You may not want to do that, but you can do it. What happens when we have very strong emotions is that we get what Bowen called flooded. We simply are overwhelmed by the emotion. We cannot think rationally. We can't behave appropriately. We are just simply flooded. Whether it's anxiety or grief or anger, we just get to a point sometimes when we just can't think. Babies get flooded regularly by their emotions. They can't do much about them. They're afraid. They cry. They scream. If they're a little older, they have a temper tantrum. They're just totally out of control, flooded by their emotions. And the most we can do is to keep them safe and comfortable until gradually they come down, and then they can start behaving appropriately again. Okay, we already said on Wednesday that the kinds of emotions you express change as your brain develops. So your emotions get more differentiated, they get more specific, and the ways you can express them change as you develop, as your body changes, as your ability to move and your ability to speak change as you develop. You can express your emotions in different ways. Cognitively, you're also developing. That was the second unit. Right? Cognitively, you are also developing. Infants don't have many cognitive skills, and they're not very rational. So they are driven by the engine of their emotions. But as we develop, we have to put together in appropriate ways the emotional responses we are having and our rational thinking. And Bowen's contribution is the notion of differentiation of emotion and thinking, starting from the undifferentiated state of the infant, which is pretty much just emotional, adding the cognitive skills to that, and gradually being able to separate them so that you can, as you mature, you can be experiencing a strong emotion and thinking rationally at the same time. And then ideally integrating those two. Remember differentiation and integration? Mm-hmm. So that you can have the emotion, think about the emotion, experience the emotion, think rationally about the emotion, and put them together in a single system of your own behavior that allows you to experience strong emotions without being flooded, and think well about those emotions and make choices about how you respond to the emotions, how you respond to other people while you're feeling a strong emotion, and how to respond to other people's strong emotions without getting flooded by catching them. Okay. So there are really two notions of differentiation in Bowen's approach. One is you are differentiating your thinking and your feeling and putting them back together, integrating them into a single mature personality. And at the same time, you are differentiating your emotions, what you're feeling, from other people. So that you're not being caught up in other people's feelings all the time. So that when somebody is feeling a strong emotion, you are aware of it because it's contagious. You can't not be aware of it as long as you have a shred of empathy left. You will be aware of the other person's feelings, but you recognize that they are that person's feelings. And although you are having the empathetic response, you know, the other person is anxious, so you're feeling a little anxious too, you understand that that person has his or her anxiety, But what you're feeling is her feeling, and you don't have any reason to be anxious. So you're differentiating your feelings from the other person's feelings. And that allows you not to be caught up in the other person's flooding, if that's what's happening. It lets you behave reasonably rationally, even though you're aware of the feeling that the other person is having and can respond appropriately. Development for Bowen includes, among other things, but what I want to focus on is increasing awareness of the difference between emotion and thought, understanding what triggers your emotions, differentiating your feelings from other people's feelings, and the development of the ability to think and feel at the same time. To think about why you're feeling what you're feeling, to be aware of that, and then to choose the thinking part, the rational part, to choose appropriate behaviors so that you don't mess up somebody else's life by behaving inappropriately because you're feeling strong emotions. In other words, just because you're panicked about something doesn't mean you have to hurt other people. Just because you're angry about something doesn't mean you have to hit kids or threaten people or make them afraid of you. The mature person, Bowen says, can feel strong feelings, know why they're feeling them, and behave in ways that don't make other people experience feelings that they don't need. And we'll go on from there on Wednesday.